Side 2, An Agent in Place by Robert Little, continuing on page 40. To make matters worse, Victor's doting secretary, Evgenia Leonovna, had slipped on a patch of ice in front of her apartment building, spraining her left wrist. She had phoned up in tears to say she would be out for 2 days, and to remind him where she kept the homemade confiture for his tea. The plump secretary dispatched from the center's pool of temporaries reeked of what the old hands around the building called Stalin's breath, a mass-produced perfume, could not even spell the center's name correctly, and brewed the worst glass of tea Victor had ever tasted, one that no amount of confiture could save. On top of everything, she whined. She was whining over the telephone now. "There's a Captain Kruchtin out here." Victor could hear his irritated chief of section correcting her. "My name happens to be Krustin, not Kruchtin." "Kruchtin, Krustin, whichever," the secretary whined into the phone. "He wants to know if he can have a minute of your time. What do I tell him?"
"You tell him you are sorry you mispronounced his name. You tell him to come straight in."
"I would offer you a glass of tea," Victor told his section chief when he had been admitted to the office, "but you might never drink that particular liquid again if I did." Krustin, as usual, came straight to the point. "I may have stumbled onto something interesting," he told Victor. He had been scanning snatches of conversation picked up by a microphone buried in the wall near the bulletin board in the American Embassy's administrative section. One of the three newcomers to the embassy, the woman named Harkenrider, had been overheard inviting someone named Ben to have a drink with her at the embassy lounge at 4. Krustin divined that the Ben in question was the Arms Control Unit housekeeper, Benedict Bassett, because of a reference in the conversation to the briefing they had both received from the security officer, Custer. Bassett had begged off, saying he had to see someone at 4:15. As Victor would see, the mention of a 4:15 appointment was significant. Later in the afternoon, a microphone embedded in the wall of the outer office of the CIA station had picked up the secretary informing Inkerman that his 4:15 had arrived. "She never uses proper names because they worry about bugs," Krustin explained. "She always refers to visitors by the hour of their appointment." Victor was beginning to see what his section chief was driving at. "You think this Benedict Bassett had an appointment with Inkerman?" Inkerman's response to his secretary over the intercom came across loud and clear. He said, "Send him on in." "Him," Victor repeated thoughtfully, reaching down to massage a swollen ankle. Krustin put into words the obvious question. What business could a housekeeper for the Arms Control Implementation Unit have with the CIA station chief? A light appeared in each of Victor's eyes. "If it really was Bassett up there," he told Krustin, "it could mean he is more than a housekeeper." For the first time since his wife had gone off on location, Victor's imagination conjured up something other than the vision of her chalk-white body spiking itself on the circumcised penis of an alcoholic Jewish hustler in a cheap hotel room. "By all means, let's put Bassett onto our priority target list," he instructed Krustin. "Don't stint. I want Section 3 to assign an entire team to him. If this Bassett is really more than a housekeeper, we are starting out with the great advantage that he does not know we know. Let's not lose it by being overeager or unprofessional." Victor swiveled in his chair and contemplated the thick ribbons of snow slanting across his field of vision toward the street below. For a delicious moment, he savored the illusion that the snow was perfectly still and he was rocketing up through it. A pensive smile etched fault lines in his weathered cheeks. The sensation of being at long last in motion caused Victor's joints to tingle from something other than gout. Chapter 6. The moment Aida started up the narrow staircase, feeling her way in the pitch darkness because the light bulbs had burned out and replacements could not be found, she knew she had lost the race to be the first to use the communal kitchen. The pungent odor of cooked cabbage filled the stairwells and grew more intense as she mounted. On her floor, the fifth, it was overpowering. Aida would have liked to get Sava's dinner started and the boy to bed at a reasonable hour, but she had been held up by the lines at the gastronome on the ground floor of the building next door. The shelves had been almost bare when she arrived, but that had not stopped people from queuing. There had been 7 lines, actually, one for the frozen sardines that were so small the man behind her had claimed they were minnows, a second for the runty potatoes studded with eyes that had sprouted, a third for the loaf of dry black bread, a fourth to pay for everything, then another round of queuing to hand in the stamped slips and retrieve the items. Now, fumbling at the end of a long day to insert the skeleton key in the lock, Aida felt drained of energy, of hope. Her feet might have been made of lead, her heart also. She pushed open the door, forced what could pass for a smile onto her face, and called out, "Sava, it's me! It's Aida! Come home at last!" Sava came bounding down the corridor into Aida's arms. He planted a wet kiss squarely on her lips. Aida loved it that at 11 he had no inhibitions about being physical with his mother. Grabbing her hand, he tugged her past the kitchen, where the woman who shared the apartment was grating cooked beets into a meatless borscht, toward the bathroom. "Aida, come see what Vadim is up to," Sava cried in a voice pitched high with excitement. The boy pulled Aida along the hallway, crammed with cartons of books and valises packed with summer clothing, past the communal refrigerator, into the long, narrow bathroom that managed to smell of sewage no matter how often it was disinfected. Vadim, who was filling a large jar with rust-colored water trickling from a bathtub tap, raised his eyes and flashed a lopsided grin in his wife's direction. Aida's future ex-husband, he categorically refused to get a divorce until he could move into a penthouse apartment overlooking the Moscow River, and he couldn't do that until the present occupant obtained legal custody of her son so that the two of them could emigrate to Israel, had the gaunt, pinched face of a lapsed alcoholic. His eyes, dark peach pits, sunken into his skull, bloodshot from the liters of cheap vodka he consumed daily, were fixed in the permanent squint of someone about to make a sales pitch. The skin on the back of his hands crawled with warts. From time to time, his entire body trembled like a leaf caught in a current of air. There were moments when Aida wondered what Vadim's mistress saw in him. There were moments when she had difficulty remembering what she had seen in him. "He says we will all get drunk and go to America," Sava announced gravely. "He says the streets there are paved with discarded Sony Walkmans, some of which can still be made to work." "I have no desire to go to America," Aida said. "I am perfectly satisfied to be here." She turned on Vadim. "Why do you put foolish ideas in his head?" Vadim, who had spent the afternoon drinking Retsina with a diplomat friend just back from Athens, slurred his words as he answered, "And what is so foolish about going to America? It is a place where ideas are run up flagpoles. There Madison Street leads the world in advertising. Chances are they could use a creative Russian Jew who has experience pitching products nobody wants to buy." Aida regarded the jar in the bathtub. "So, what is it you are concocting?"
"I got the recipe from my taxi driver who got it from a chemist from Uzbekistan. You mix in rice, you mix in sugar if you can find sugar, saccharin if not, you mix in some fruit. I found a peasant selling dried peaches at the central market. Don't ask me what I paid for them, because if I told you, which I won't, you would physically assault me. You mix it all up in a jar, you add beer, you add warm water, you cover the jar with a rubber surgeon's glove. As the mixture ferments, the glove inflates. When all the fingers are sticking up, the great helmsman's greeting, which is what the cocktail is called, is ready to drink."
"Why do you bother when you have enough money to buy all the alcohol you can drink on the black market?" Aida demanded.
"I do it because it is illegal," Vadim explained. "I plan to present a bottle to the deputy vice minister in charge of the state advertising budget."
Sava asked Vadim, "What does it mean, ferment?" Vadim turned off the tap, fitted the rubber glove over the lid with a rubber band, and carefully lifted the jar out of the tub. "Ferment is what happens when something rots."
"Like when communism ferments?" Sava asked brightly. Vadim snickered. "Where can I put the jar so it is in the dark?" he asked Aida.
Aida went back into the corridor and hung her coat and fox fur on a hook. Vadim, carrying the jar with the rubber glove attached as if it were a lid, trailed after her. "While you were busy buying your dried peaches," Aida asked over her shoulder, "did you by any chance find meat for supper?"
"To tell the truth, I didn't look. If you want, I could phone up my taxi driver and have him bring us something from a restaurant."
Luckily, I found some sardines, Aida told him as she kicked off her galoshes and fitted her feet into fleece-lined bedroom slippers.
I think I would prefer meat.
If you wanted meat, you should have thought about it when you were paying a small fortune for fruit at the central market. Imagine buying fruit in winter.
Vadim followed her into the room that served as a living room and Aida's bedroom. It was furnished with a narrow wooden bed covered with a bright Uzbek shawl, an armoire with mirrors in the doors, a round wooden table that Aida used as a desk when meals were not being served, makeshift shelves overflowing with books and manuscripts and magazines, and three faded oil paintings hung, the way Russians always hang paintings, high on the wall.
Money, Vadim muttered, looking around for a place to store his jar, is not my problem. In any case, buying fruit in winter is a poetic gesture. You of all people should be able to relate to that.
Poetry is food for the soul. Sava also needs food for the stomach. Aida, sorting through the mail piled on the round table, tossed the typewritten envelopes behind the radiator with the others already there. It was a matter of absolute principle with her never to open typewritten envelopes or read typewritten letters. She settled into the only decent chair in the room to take a look at the handwritten note postmarked Leningrad. The letter turned out to be from the head of the Pushkin Memorial Committee. He was offering to pay her way to the city she called Peter, after its founder, Peter the Great, and everyone else called Leningrad, if she would agree to read some of Pushkin's poems at the gathering marking the anniversary of the poet's death in February. Vadim shoved aside a pile of Aida's books and squeezed his precious jar onto a shelf in the armoire. Quite pleased with himself, he started recounting the latest joke.
Speaking of meat, did you hear about the woman who stands on line for 2 hours? When she finally reaches the counter, she asks the salesman for meat. He tells her...
Vadim couldn't keep from smirking at his own joke.
Here we have no fish. Next door is where they have no meat.
Aida didn't laugh.
Why is it always the woman who stands on line in your jokes?
Vadim shook his head in disgust.
Where's your sense of humor? He muttered under his alcoholic breath. And wobbling unsteadily, he staggered toward the room he shared with Sava.
Tears of frustration, of outrage, welled up. As always, Aida resisted the urge to weep. She had lost what sense of humor she still had somewhere between the center of Moscow and the maritime station, Rechnoy Vokzal, the last stop on the Gorkovskaya metro line. Jammed into the subway car, swaying with the motion of the train, she had felt a hand rub against her buttocks. Twisting around, she had slapped the fat man squeezed up against her.
He had bellowed in surprise and had accused her of being mentally deranged.
The other passengers had stared at her as if she was.
Maybe they sensed something she didn't.
It was true that she could not remember the last time she had burst out laughing, the last time she had found someone or something funny.
Humor seemed to have been squeezed out of her life. What was funny about scavenging for rubles to make ends meet? Or queuing week in, week out for the pills that her son needed to remain alive. Or living with a filthy rich future ex who could afford meat but forgot to buy it. Where was the humor in spending a small fortune to buy peaches in winter? Her future ex had probably paid 20 rubles for them. For 20 rubles she could have bought 2 chickens on the black market, 3 if they were small ones. Aida heaved herself out of the chair. She felt as if she could have sat there forever. And knelt down next to the mint geranium she left on the floor so that it would catch the beams of sunlight during the day, the beams of moonlight at night that knifed between 2 tall buildings across the street. Was an occasional beam of sunlight or moonlight nourishment enough for a plant? Was one small plant clinging to life nourishment enough for a poet? Reflecting on the poetic possibilities of the riddle, she made her way along the corridor to her father's tiny bedroom. She opened the door the width of a finger and looked in. As always at this hour, Ivan had taken up the vigil that would last until dawn. In the metallic moonlight seeping into the room, she could just make him out, sitting in his wicker chair drawn up to the double windows with a layer of cotton on the sill between the 2 panes to absorb moisture, staring silently into the night, scratching absently at the hair as thick as broom bristles on his chin, lost in thought, lost in fear. His right hand would be on his cane, Aida knew, ready to tap out a staccato message of alarm on the floor if they came. At the slightest sound from outside, a car door slamming, a cat screeching, the whine of brakes, his heartbeat would quicken, and he would lean forward anxiously. Although Aida could not see his eyes, she could imagine them. They would have the wild concentration of someone who had spent a lifetime waiting. Two lines of Akhmatova's leapt into her head. Faces fall apart. Fear looks out from under the eyelids. Was she missing the humor of the situation, she wondered? At supper, Sava, pulling a face, gulped down his pills, then again asked Aida to explain why Grandfather Ivan slept days and stayed awake nights. Again, Aida told him he was too young to understand. How old would he have to be, Sava wanted to know. 12? 13? Maybe when you are 13, she told him. 13, he said gloomily, is too far away to touch. Vadim, sucking noisily on the head of a sardine, snorted. Me also. I'm too far away from 13 to touch it, he said. He started to laugh, but stopped when he saw that Aida was not amused. She turned back to Sava and asked him what he had studied in history class that day. When he told her, she said, No, it did not happen at all like that, even if your textbook says it did. And scraping the last bits of fish from the sardine skeleton onto Sava's plate, she proceeded to set the record straight. Stalin had not been the wise war leader pictured in the textbook. He had failed to heed warnings that the Nazis planned to attack. The Air Force had been caught on the ground and destroyed. The Red Army had suffered dreadful losses and had been driven back to the gates of Moscow. Stalin himself had panicked and disappeared for 10 days. If the tide of war had eventually turned, it had been due more to the courage of the Russian soldiers and their determination to defend the motherland. It had been despite Stalin, not because of him. Lying in bed later, Aida found herself straining to catch sounds from the street. She tried to picture herself bursting into spontaneous laughter at some sight, some comment, but the image eluded her. She wondered if fear could be passed like a virus from one person to another. She wondered if she had been infected by her father. She wondered if she would infect Sava. There was a scuffing sound at the door leading to Sava's room. A stain of light spread on the floor as the door swung open. Vadim padded across the room in his bare feet and sank down on the edge of the bed. In the darkness, he groped under the blankets, under her nightdress, and began to run his fingers along the inside of her thigh. "Remember how it used to be between us," he whispered hoarsely. Aida was sorely tempted. She did have a garden full of lust, and would have welcomed taking momentary refuge in the sanctuary of the sex act. Vadim must have sensed her hesitating because he became bolder, working his hand up to her pubic hair. "Relax," he whispered. "Enjoy it." He leaned toward her until his face was hovering above hers. She got a whiff of the liquor on his breath. Suddenly, the idea of being kissed by his alcoholic lips killed whatever desire she felt. She pushed his hand away. "It is out of the realm of possibility," she murmured. Vadim wrenched his hand out from under the blanket, as if it had been burned. "What a cunt you are, Aida," he muttered angrily, and smothering a belch in the sleeve of his bathrobe, he lumbered back toward his room to crawl into bed alongside Sava. Aida sat up. Her breath came in pained gasps. "There is more to me than cunt," she called after him in the fierce whisper that people in communal apartments used when they argued. Before she could say anything else, the door clicked closed, erasing the stain of light on the floor. Sinking back onto the pillow, Aida let her lids drift closed over her eyes. In her mind's eye, the stain of light lingered, increasing in intensity. The absence of darkness did not annoy her. It reminded her of the white nights she dearly loved in Peter. She encountered a vision of her father staring unblinkingly through the double panes into the night, and began to put words to the images that had been orbiting each other in her head. "At first light, the trolleys grinding up the hill, we pressed against each other, whispering. By the bed, a canvas satchel stuffed with tea, a collected works, paper, pencil, a photo of me. How can you be sure?" I asked. It was the way he looked at me. How did he look at you? As if I were transparent. In the street, the whine of brakes, his body stiff against mine, embraced the sound. "We are into morning," I said.
If they have not come by now. Try to get some sleep, I said. I pulled the cover over his head. You do not need to do that, he said. The memory of a white night had overpowered light. Chapter 7. From the moment Ben Bassett's foot touched Russian soil, places and people and things he had never set eyes on seemed hauntingly familiar. His father's father, the Russian roots of Ben's service record, had warned him it would be like that, had warned him that he would have the impression of reliving an incarnation, had warned him that he would feel Russia pulling at him like gravity through the thick soles of his L.L. Bean hunting boots. Now, wandering on a narrow, slush-filled back street behind the Bolshoi Theater late one afternoon, 2 weeks after his arrival in Moscow, stopping to buy a handful of hazelnuts from a vendor wearing tinted plastic ski goggles, he thought he could hear his grandfather laughing with that peculiar stifled sound that was half cough and half cackle at the riot of emotions raging in his grandson's head. Ben had been weaned on things Russian, the dry, self-mocking humor, the tendency to laugh in undertones so as not to attract attention to yourself, the use of dignity as a kind of armor, the use of alcohol as a kind of palliative. It was at the knee of his grandfather that Ben had learned about the intricate declensions that gave to the Russian language a suppleness few tongues matched, about the vastness of the steppe that gave to the Russian soul its dread of unordered space, of unstructured existence, about the coldness of the Russian winter that gave to the Russian heart its morbid conviction that life was essentially tragedy. In his youth, Ben's grandfather had been caught up in the idealism of the revolution, had fought in one of Trotsky's mobile Red Guard battalions during the Civil War, had become disenchanted when a rude Georgian peasant named Yosef Vissarionovich Dugashvili, better known to the world by his underground name Stalin, manipulated his way to power on the death of Lenin in 1924, had stowed away on a steamer bound for Istanbul and points west one jump ahead of the Cheka agents hunting him as an enemy of the people, had wound up, ancient before he was old, operating a projector in a Bronx motion picture theater. Even on his deathbed, with a death rattle tickling the back of his throat, the stories had continued to gush out of him. Ben remembered being struck by the fact that they had no beginning and no end, but unraveled in a long coil of narrative that broke off only when the ancient heart ceased to beat. Was it possible, Ben wondered now, making his way past a peasant woman in a thick quilted army greatcoat, peddling clumps of parsley, that it was his turn to pick up the thread of his grandfather's narrative? One way or another, he too would have a story to tell, though the number of people he could tell it to would always be extremely limited. Turning off Petrovka into a warren of streets behind the Bolshoi, Ben had to step into the gutter to avoid a group of giggling girls in short skirts and bright tights, walking on ice skate blades covered with rubber sheaths. On the spur of the moment, he decided to test his tradecraft. Before leaving Washington, he had been given a crash course by Army intelligence field agents and elaborately briefed by a nuts-and-bolts type with credentials identifying him as a State Department security officer. The nuts-and-bolts man had discouraged him from practicing tradecraft in the streets of Moscow, first because Ben, according to the field agents, was not very adept at it, then because his failure to spot anyone following him might mean that the Russians had assigned one of their crack teams to him, employing teams that made use of women and even children as well as men, that constantly shifted the point agent, that sometimes trailed targets from in front rather than from behind, made it virtually impossible to pick up the tail. Ben paused to look at the display of hockey sticks and ice skates in the window of a sports store, and used the window to study the street behind him. As far as he could observe in the accumulating darkness, no one on the street appeared to take the slightest interest in him. No one turned away or changed his or her trajectory. No one stopped suddenly to window shop in front of another store. No automobile pulled over to the curb and parked with its motor idling. From somewhere overhead, Ben heard the quick silvery ripple of a soprano voice skating back and forth across scales. Stepping back off the curb and looking up, he could make out the large windows of a second-floor rehearsal studio. Someone played a few chords on a piano. Then, with the piano accompanying her, the soprano began to sing the opening measures of a well-known aria. She stopped abruptly. The piano repeated a phrase twice. The soprano tried it again, without the piano. A man's voice could be heard exhorting her. "You are swallowing vowels," he cried. "Spit them out!" The singer attempted the phrase again. It was apparently satisfactory because she went back to the beginning and, with the piano accompanying her, continued on past the phrase. Under the rehearsal studio, a big-boned woman pushed through the double doors leading to the street. She stood for a moment with her coat open, her gloves off and tucked under an armpit, counting with naked fingers a wad of rubles. Ben was instantly alert to her. He had never seen anyone quite like her in Moscow, or anywhere else for that matter. In this incarnation, or any of the previous incarnations his grandfather insisted he had had, she looked as if she had walked off a 1930s movie set. Planted squarely on her large head was a pillbox hat with an enormous white feather spiked through it. Around her neck she had flung a threadbare fox neckpiece with a shrunken fox's head on one end that stared out at the world with unblinking marble eyes, almost as if it were stalking the hunter who had shot it. The fox, in turn, was draped over a worn cloth coat lined with what looked like a green army blanket. The slush-stained hem of a thick ankle-length black skirt appeared to foam around her galoshes as she stamped her feet to keep them warm. Apparently satisfied with the count, the woman stuffed the money in a coat pocket and pulled on her gloves. She must have become aware of the singing coming from above because she angled her head up and cocked an ear, then backed over to stand near Ben and listen. The soprano voice broke off. A male voice, straining to reach an octave above its normal range, demonstrated the phrasing. The soprano attacked the passage several times without the piano, then with it. Ben turned to the woman and said in Russian, "Tosca, Act 2, Scene 2." Without taking her eyes off the windows of the rehearsal studio, the woman shook her head. "Turandot, I do not know the act, but there can be no discussion. I would recognize it anywhere." Ben asked, "Are you a singer?" The woman slowly turned her head toward Ben and studied him, her eyes as fixed as those of the fox peering from her shoulder. Then she said in a tone that did not invite him to continue the conversation, "In a manner of speaking, yes." Ben became aware of the broken, badly set nose. Curiously, the deformation only made her more sensual. He tried out a smile on her, but it didn't dent the wall of indifference behind which she seemed to be barricaded. "If you are a singer," he challenged her, "can you explain what pushes human beings to sing?" The woman sniffed at the imbecility of the question. "What is it that makes a bird sing?" Ben retorted, "Only a skydiver can know what makes a bird sing." The woman half smiled as the image struck her, then burst out laughing. To Ben's ear, the laughter sounded rusty, as if it hadn't been used in a long time. The woman appeared to inch out from behind her wall of indifference. "You speak with some kind of an accent," she noted. "I am American. Is this your first visit to Kuchkova?" "What is Kuchkova?" The woman seemed quite pleased with herself. "That is the original name of Moscow. It tickles the Slavophile in me to use it." Ben said, "I am not a tourist. I should tell you right off that I work at the American Embassy. I am a very junior diplomat." The woman surprised him by switching to English. "I have never before now recountered someone from the other side of the looking glass. I must admit that America does not fascinate me the way it fascinates others. I have heard it spoken that the only original American contribution to world culture is the banjo." Ben answered in Russian. "You are forgetting the rocking chair," he said good-humoredly, "and baseball." She laughed at this. "You speak Russian good for a foreign person. You speak it like me. Well, not exactly like me." She smiled self-consciously at her English. "Almost like me." "Your English is as good as my Russian," Ben said. "Where did you pick it up?" "In prison," she replied, measuring him to see what effect her reply would have. "I once shared a cell with a Hungarian origin lady that formerly instructed the English grammar for the children of Hungarian diplomats. She had a Russian husband who got into what, with your love of clichés, call heated water. I have nothing against clichés, mind you. Clichés are dead poems. When the Hungarian origin lady defended her Russian husband, she got also into heated water.
In this prison, she to me recited English poems. In exchange, I to her recited Russian poems, mostly but not always Akhmatova, some Pushkin, some Mandelstam.
Above their heads, the soprano reached for a high note and missed. The woman with the broken nose winced. She and Ben exchanged conspiratorial smiles. More of the wall behind which the woman was barricaded crumbled. She studied Ben frankly, then asked,
"So, are you a skydiver?"
"In a manner of speaking, yes." This made her laugh again.
"It does not change the fact that what she's singing, though not very well, is Turandot and not Tosca.
You want to bet?" The woman switched back to Russian. "You are very sure of yourself. I do not think that is such a good thing in a man. To be less sure is to be more open." Angling her head, she half smiled again at the idea of taking him down a peg.
"What is it you would have us bet?"
"If I lose, I will buy you a cup of coffee and a piece of cake. If you lose, you will buy me a cup of coffee and a piece of cake." The woman was clearly tempted. Above their heads, the soprano broke off again as her teacher demonstrated the phrasing of still another passage. The teacher and the soprano repeated the passage in chorus. In the street, the white feather piercing the pillbox hat quivered in the icy evening currents of air. The woman came to a decision. Not coffee, but hot wine. Not cake, but finger sandwiches. Ben, surprised, nodded. He hadn't expected her to agree. She nodded in return and disappeared through the double doors into the building. The soprano's voice stopped in mid-phrase, and for 2 or 3 minutes the piano and the soprano were both silent. After they resumed, the woman with the fox around her neck reappeared on the street. She walked directly up to Ben and regarded him with her characteristic half-smile that had very little to do with humor and a great deal to do with nervousness. "Tosca, Act 2, Scene 2," she said. She turned on her heel and started to walk off, then stopped to look over her shoulder. Seeing Ben's uncertainty, she called, "A bet is a bet," and motioned with her head for him to follow her. He fell into step alongside her. They passed the peasant woman selling parsley and rounded the corner. "Where are you taking me?" Ben inquired.
"There is a café called the Druzhba on the corner of Petrovka and Kuznetsky Most at the Petrovka Passage."
They walked in silence, pushing through a swarm of teenage girls with painted eyes and rouged cheeks, standing in front of a store window watching a Russian rock singer on television. Further on, they had to detour around workmen, digging up a segment of sidewalk with jackhammers. When they were far enough away from the jackhammers to make themselves heard, Ben commented that he found Moscow incredibly noisy. "If cities were quiet," the woman remarked, "people would not live in them." "Explain yourself," Ben insisted. "Contrary to what our sociologists tell us," she said, "the real reason people congregate in monstrous warts we call cities has little to do with economics and a lot to do with loneliness. Noise provides evidence that we are not alone." Ben asked her what she thought of perestroika. The woman said she thought it was a fine thing, as far as it went. The trouble was that it did not go far enough. It did not go to the root of the problem, which was to define the role of the Communist Party in a society that had been ruined by the Communist Party. She had read an American novel called Catch something or other, she said. "Catch 22, he prompted. "That was it," she said, "Catch 22. We Russians have our own Catch 22. Under Stalin, under Khrushchev, under Brezhnev, policy was set at the top and everyone fell into line. Now the policy set at the top is that policy should not be set at the top. It would be funny if it were not a matter of life and death, but it was a matter of life and death. There was a time bomb ticking away in the Soviet Union," she told him. "The current bosses justified their reforms by pointing to the terrible condition of the economy. It was only a matter of time before their enemies, prominent among them, the ultra-right-wing anti-Semitic nationalist circle that went by the name of Pamyat, or memory, cited these same conditions as proof that the reforms were not working." Ben asked her what would happen then. She shouldered through a line of people queuing at a kiosk for waffles stuffed with frozen strawberries. An old man who thought she was trying to get in ahead of him insulted her, but she ignored him and strode on. Ben made his way around the end of the line and caught up with the woman who had lost the bet. He repeated his question. What would happen when Pamyat cited the economic conditions as proof that the reforms were not working? The woman hiked a shoulder in irritation. On her neck, the fox's head nodded in eager agreement. Perestroika would give way to Perestrelka, she said. Did he know the word? Perestrelka was Russian for shootout. Some people will start shooting at other people. Ben wanted to know what she would do if that happened. The woman breathed out into the cold air. A cloud of vapor swirled around her face. I will duck for as long as such a thing is possible, she announced. But violence is a circle. I will certainly end up wounding someone. With Ben trailing after her, she pushed through a revolving door into the Druzhba Cafe, stamped the slush off her galoshes on a worn doormat, and strode past the coat room into the crowded, noisy, smoke-filled cafe. Looking around, she spotted a free table and went over to claim it. Settling onto the metal chair with a sigh of relief, she pulled off her gloves, loosened the fox fur around her neck, and opened the buttons of her coat. Ben sat opposite her and unbuttoned his sheepskin overcoat. A waiter in a stained black dinner jacket delivered two drinks and a plate of sandwiches to the next table, then turned to them. Two glasses of hot wine, the woman ordered, and a plate of liverwurst sandwiches. Ben said, My name is Benedict, which is the long version of Ben. The woman reached into the pocket of her coat, came up with some paper and tobacco, and began to roll a thin cigarette. Mine is Zinaida Ivanovna. My son shortened Zinaida to Aida, which is what my friends call me. Ben watched her moving fingers, fascinated by their dexterity. I will call you what your friends call you. If you have a son, you must be married. When Aida saw that Ben expected an answer, she said with a trace of irony, That is not a question. Ben watched her fingers work the tobacco onto the paper and deftly roll it. Are you married? In a manner of speaking, yes. Every time I ask you something, you reply in a manner of speaking. Aida licked the paper closed, then struck a match with her thumbnail and held it to the tip of her cigarette. She filled the air with a haze of unpleasant-smelling smoke before she replied, I am married, and I am not married, she said presently, which is to say, I have a husband, but Vadim, which is the name of my future ex, has a mistress with whom he is madly in love. He and I are only waiting for him to move out of my apartment to get divorced. What prevents him from moving out right away? He has his heart set on moving into a penthouse overlooking the Moscow River. Before he can do that, the woman who lives there must get legal custody of her son so they can emigrate to Israel. The logistics of life in Moscow can be complicated. Aida smiled bitterly. It is the complications that save us, if we did not have them. If life were relatively simple, if you could buy a pair of stockings without queuing on three lines and move out of an apartment when you wanted to get divorced, there would be time to think. And then where would we be? Ben wanted to know how she had met her husband. You ask a great many questions, Aida noted. That is the usual way of starting a friendship. Clearly annoyed, she dragged on her cigarette, exhaled a perfect ring of smoke, and watched it lose its form as it drifted away. What we have, she said, is not a friendship. We made a bet. I lost. So I will buy you a glass of warm wine. That will be the beginning and the end of our relationship. The waiter returned and set two glass mugs of hot red wine on the table, along with a plate of small sandwiches. Ben wrapped his fingers around his glass to warm them. I would still like to know how you met your husband. Aida shrugged quickly, stubbed out her cigarette in an ashtray, and started eating a sandwich. She spoke with her mouth full. So? We were both of us students at Lomonosov University on the Lenin Hills. In order to make money to buy books, I found a part-time job washing windows in office buildings. One day I was washing a window, and Vadim suddenly appeared on a scaffold washing the same window from the outside. Ben sipped his wine. He relished the warmth in his throat. What was it that attracted you to him? His sense of humor, his Jewishness, his insolence, his courage even. He would say the most scandalous things about the bosses, even with other people around. He had the knack of passing off as a joke things that were deadly serious. The day I met him, he pressed his face to the window, flattening his nose. He wrote on the glass backwards in soap, "Will you marry me?" I shook my head, "No." So he wrote, "Will you at least sleep with me?" Unlike most of the boys I knew, Vadim did not beat around the bush. I wrote back on my side of the window, "Может быть, maybe." He did a jig on the scaffold. That is how I always imagine him, doing a jig on the scaffold 12 floors above the street. "How long were you married before you had your son?" Aida sipped her hot wine, then brought the glass up to warm her cheek. "Vadim is not the father of my son," she said softly. Ben waited for her to go on. "Why do I tell you all this?" She shrugged. "I had a friend who became a lover. He was a wonderful friend, a wonderful lover. He was an editor. He died of old age at 32. A film of tears transformed Aida's eyes into mirrors. She half smiled at a memory. He spoke Russian with a Polish accent and lisped. He left a message on his telephone answering machine. 'I talk before the beep, you talk after,' is what it said. After he died, I phoned up 2 or 3 times a day for weeks to hear his Polish accent and his lisp. One day I called and found that his voice had been replaced by the recorded voice of his widow. 'What do you want?' is what it said. What I wanted was him. It was on that day that I recorded his death in my journal." "What did Vadim say when you gave birth to a son who was not his?" "Vadim and I had long since stopped being lovers and become comrades. About Sava, he was very chic. He always treated him as if he were his own son." "What happened between you and Vadim? What went wrong?" "He retained his insolence, but lost his sense of humor. In order to make people laugh, he was reduced to telling jokes." Aida smiled wistfully. "It is not possible." She slowly shook her head and repeated the phrase as if she were reminding herself of a fact of life, to survive in Russia without a sense of humor. Nibbling on one of the sandwiches, Ben noticed that a young woman sitting alone at another table was glancing furtively at his companion. The young woman, gathering her courage, scraped back her chair and approached their table. She offered a ballpoint pen and a small notebook to Aida. "I am a great fan of yours, Zinaida Ivanovna. Would you give me an autograph?" Aida scribbled her name in the notebook. "I will treasure this for the rest of my life," the young woman announced with great seriousness. Half bowing, she backed away from the table. Ben, flustered, asked, "Are you famous?" Aida laughed. "Pasternak, said to be famous, is indecent," she replied. "To answer your question, I am slightly indecent." "What kind of things do you sing?" "I said I was a singer in a manner of speaking. What I do is rummage in the debris of language. I listen to silence. What I am is a poet." Ben was impressed. "If I knew your family name, could I find your books?" "I had one collection published years ago, but it has long since gone out of print. I have been told that one of those new private publishing houses is ready to bring out a collected works, but I will believe it when I see it. I do translations of poems, always from the American, always by women poets. Emily Dickinson is my special passion. Some of my less controversial poems are occasionally taken by journals. When you met me, I had come from collecting money for 2 poems being published by Novy Mir. I am often invited to read my poems. I never refuse. What fame I have comes from that." Aida popped another sandwich into her mouth and washed it down with a gulp of wine. Ben asked, "What is it about your controversial poems that makes them controversial?" Aida thought about this. "They are about the one subject still taboo in Russia, despite glasnost and the new openness in the press, and that is sex. My point of view, it goes without saying, is feminist. I am all for liberating men from the straitjacket of the party, but I want also to liberate men from the straitjacket of the penis and women from the straitjacket of men. My future ex claims that I am the founder and only member of the tiniest splinter group in the Soviet Union, which is to say the feminist movement." Ben said, "How did you become a feminist? How did you become a poet?" Aida raised a hand and signaled the waiter to bring the check. "I did not become a feminist or a poet," she explained impatiently. "In her experience, men usually made the same mistake. I have always been a feminist and a poet. God planted the seed of feminism within my body when he created me. As for poetry, everyone in Russia is a poet in the sense that for the last 70 years everything really important has been said between the lines. Even as a small child, I was mesmerized by the spaces between the lines, between the words, which is what I meant when I spoke about listening to silence. Poetry is what is hidden in the spaces between the lines, between the words. A blizzard of snow was falling on Moscow when they pushed through the revolving door to the street. Aida, accustomed to the weather, wrapped her fox tightly around her neck, pulled on her gloves, and turned to leave. Ben, squinting into the snow, shouted over the storm, "Can I see you again, Aida?" She turned back. "That is simply not possible." "Why?" Flashing a wistful half-smile, Aida studied the ground, stamped her feet on the thin layer of sanded ice, then raised her eyes to gaze directly into Ben's. Flakes had caked his brows, turning them white. She had a vision of what he would look like as an old man. "My life is complicated enough," she called over the storm. "I do not want to complicate it further by sleeping with an American and a diplomat to boot." Ben was not prepared for her bluntness. "I was not proposing that we sleep together, only that we meet, that we get to know each other. I am as direct as Vadim in things that concern bodily functions," Aida announced. "You are interested in my body, or at least the body you have imagined under all these layers of clothing. I have a garden of lust of my own, which means I am not uninterested in your body." Peering into the pupils of his eyes, two points of darkness in a sea of olive green, she was struck by their feverish alertness. For some reason, his eyes seemed familiar. "Your head seems relatively interesting, too. If you propose another meeting and I accept, what would it be for except to get involved? The sex act. The act of sex is what we both have in mind. Why pretend otherwise? So, we would meet again, we would circle each other for a suitable length of time, hunting for points we have in common. What a coincidence we both love Tosca, in order to create the illusion of a connivance. You would use every trick in the book to convince me that you were not violent, so that I would not be afraid to collaborate in what is essentially a violent act." "If you really believe all that," Ben shouted, "why did you come with me today?" "I came with you because you made me laugh," she called. "You will have guessed by now that I have not laughed in a long time." She sniffed at the air, testing the coldness in her nostrils, then shivered and hugged herself, almost as if she were holding herself together. It dawned on Ben that it was her body language, more than her body, that accounted for her incredible sensuality. "There is another reason I agreed to come with you," she added, elevating her chin a notch. One of the whimsical smiles that Ben was starting to recognize appeared on her lips. "I love the American accent. I love to hear the language of Emily Dickinson spoken as she might have spoken it." Squinting into the falling snow, Ben studied her broken nose, alive with freckles. He decided to memorize one thing about her every time they met, if they ever met. He shouted, "I can make you laugh again." Aida turned her head into the blizzard and closed her eyes, savoring the icy crystals that melted on her lids. Presently, she turned back to Ben. "I would be lying if I said I was not tempted." She offered her hand. "Thank you, but no thank you." An old man with a scarf wound over his mouth and nose walked between them, going toward the revolving door. As soon as he was past, Ben grasped her hand in both of his. He noticed traces of what looked like tears on her cheeks, then realized they were melted crystals of snow. Suddenly he felt himself spiral out of character. A flash flood of words that he might have spoken in a previous incarnation gushed out before he knew what he was saying. "I hope to Christ we do not meet again." Aida was stunned. What he had said, the ardor with which he had said it, the mystery hidden in the spaces between his words, pierced her chest, and she found herself short of breath. Everything that had gone before had been conversation, seduction. But his valediction had cut to a marrow, bared a nerve. She searched his eyes for the meaning of his cryptic announcement, but all she saw was a feverish alertness amid the traces of a riot of emotions. Accepting his fervor with a delicate smile that for the first time mounted like a tide creeping in as far as her gray animal eyes, She snapped a sliver of ice from the revolving door and sucked on it, then leaned forward and brushed her blue lips against his. Before he realized what had happened, she had spun away from his clumsy effort to put an arm around her and plunged into the freezing Kuchkova night. Adrift on the steps in the suddenly silent storm, Ben watched her white feather vanish among the giant clots of snow drifting lazily through the yellowish beams of streetlights.
Aida crouched next to the wicker chair, feeding broth to her father a spoonful at a time, wiping with a kitchen towel the drops that spilled down the stubble on his chin. Ivan's eyes were riveted on her as he ate. When he had finished, she set aside the bowl and picked up a plate of kasha mixed with small bits of fatty sausage. The old man pulled his head back. "Eat some of it," Aida whispered. "It is good for you." Barely moving his lips, he said in a rasping voice, "Do not lose any part of your body if you can avoid it." He held out his trembling fingers for her to see. The tips of all of them were scarred, deformed, twisted, the nails missing. They had been pulled out. His fingers had been crushed by NKVD interrogators. "These are not my fingers," the old man said matter-of-factly. "Mine were quite different." Aida looked out of the window so he would not see her reaction. She remembered the riot of emotions on the face of the strange American she had met that day. She wondered what secret had pushed him to hope they would never meet again. His eyes had seemed so familiar. It suddenly came to her where she had seen them before. The American reminded her of her Polish lover. They both had a wall of lucidity that had to be raised before you could get at their lust. Images wheeled in her brain. She discovered words to describe them. "I have hung on words you left unsaid, been moved to tears by tears you left unshed, caught your heart's ache through the snow's storm, as proof I tender my iced lips for you to warm." Putting her emotions into poetry made her better able to control them. She turned back to her father. "What about a homemade yogurt to finish off the meal?" When he did not refuse, she began feeding him yogurt by the spoonful. Between swallows, he summoned a disturbing memory. "You were a very small girl at the time," he told her. "Not more than 5 or 6. When we rented the room to him, we had no idea he had been a white Russian and an admiral. How could we have been expected to know such a thing? They moved in, the admiral, his wife, and his wife's sister. Only she wasn't his wife's sister. She was his mistress, and they were a ménage à trois, as the French say. All old, all gray-haired, one of the women hobbling on crutches with her face painted, the old admiral scurrying around like a rat trying to find food for them to eat or coal for them to burn." "I remember them very well," Aida reminded her father. "It was the first time in my life I had ever seen a woman use makeup. The one who claimed to be his wife's sister spent hours every day painting her lips to look as if she were pouting, painting her eyes to look wide and innocent. Once when I was 11, I decided to paint my lips with mercurochrome in order to look like her. When you came home and saw what I had done, you slapped my face. Then you scrubbed it." "They had somehow been overlooked," Aida's father droned on. "The old admiral, his wife, the sister who was not a sister. But one day they came and took all three of them away in a bread truck that was not a bread truck. For me, it was the beginning of the end." He shook his head again and again, trying to figure out how he had allowed it to happen. Aida wiped her father's chin with a dish towel and got up and set the empty yogurt cup on a table. "I remember I stuttered when I was a child," she said. "The woman on crutches, the one with the eyes made up to look innocent, used to imitate my stutter to tease me. Zinaida does come back," she would say. "The day they took her away, she was stuttering for real. God protect us," she cried. "I remember thinking she had taken my stutter with her, so I never stuttered again." From the street came a muffled shout, then the sound of a car door slamming. The old man strained forward, taut in his wicker chair. "Have they finally gotten around to me?" he whispered. He scraped the chair closer to the window and peered into the night that had settled over the city like a lid.
Aida was reminded of two lines from the Irish poet Yeats. When one looks into darkness, there is always something there. She came up behind her father. Through the double panes of the window, she could see two men tying a couch onto the roof of a small automobile. She rested a hand on her father's shoulder, felt his muscles relax under her touch. "Good night to you, father," she said, knowing that he was just starting his vigil, that the night, like the thousands that had gone before it, would be anything but good for him. Chapter 8. Flashing what Manny took to be a government-issue smile, Miss Macy thumbed the lever on the intercom. "Your 9 o'clock is here, Mr. Inkerman," she announced. Manny Custer realized that his daily briefing session with the CIA station chief had gotten off to a sour start, again, when he heard Charlie Inkerman's testy nasal whine spurt over the tiny speaker. "He is 10 fucking minutes late," the voice complained. "What kept you?" Inkerman growled as Manny, casually kicking the door closed behind him, ambled into the shadowy inner sanctum with its sealed Venetian blinds. "In case you have not remarked on it, I run a taut ship." Inkerman slouched in front of a teletype machine, the bald spot on the top of his head flashing an indecipherable Morse message as it caught the light from a flickering overhead fluorescent fixture. He scanned the printout, letting the paper uncoil through his stubby fingers, pursing his lips and whistling quietly through them as he took in an item that annoyed him. To Manny's ear, it sounded like a kettle coming to a boil. It was not the first time he had heard this particular kettle approach boil. Their paths had first crossed in the late 70s when Manny returned to the company's home base in Langley, Virginia, after 2 back-to-back tours in Turkey. With the help of 2 Cossack smugglers working out of Rostov-on-Don, twins known in the trade as the brothers Karamazov, he had run more than 200 agents across the Soviet Union's heavily guarded southern frontier. Even then, Inkerman, at Langley, Manny's immediate superior in a long-range intra-office project evaluating second-echelon Soviet leaders, had liked to say he ran a taut ship, though his idea of a taut ship was to set impossible deadlines and mutter salty obscenities, learned, Manny suspected, while rowing for Harvard when they were not met. The few grudging words of praise that escaped his lips were invariably sprinkled like salt in open wounds. Things had come to a head in 1979 when Manny flatly refused Inkerman's order to water down his written assessment of a new candidate member of the ruling Politburo named Mikhail Gorbachev, whom Manny saw as a potential Dubček-like reformer. Inkerman, intent on delivering a more pessimistic evaluation that would support the case for an eternally belligerent Soviet leadership and higher military and intelligence budgets, forced Manny to resign. Manny had made a number of diplomat friends during his years abroad and was quickly picked up by the State Department Security Office and posted to Bonn. When the ambassador there was transferred to Moscow, he had invited Manny, whom he admired as a no-nonsense security chief who would not tie an embassy in knots looking for security violations, to tag along with him. When the current ambassador came on board, he had inherited Manny, by then something of a fixture in Moscow, along with the furniture. Judging from the fitness reports he filed on Manny, he seemed to prefer the furniture to an outspoken security chief who said precisely what he thought. Delicately running the palm of his hand over his slicked-back hair, Inkerman lowered himself into the swivel chair behind the desk. Out of the corner of an eye, he watched Manny pull over a chair and sink into it, his legs stretched out and crossed at his thick ankles, a great expanse of sickly white skin visible above his socks, his hands clasped behind his head, his sports jacket parted like a curtain, the shirt buttons straining in their holes against a swelling stomach, the expression on his martyr's face as arrogant as ever. "The ambassador's wife is going straight up the wall over the piano string caper," Inkerman said. He rummaged in an oversized in-basket that looked like a compost heap and came up with a handwritten note, which he waved at Manny. "She says she's sure the F string didn't break by accident. She says the Ruskies knew she had personally invited the piano player. She says they somehow sneaked one of their agents into Spasso House before the concert and weakened the string so that it would break when he started tickling the ivories. She says
that it was all part of a scheme to humiliate her husband, the ambassador, and discourage cultural contacts. She says, what are you doing to make sure it doesn't happen again? Manny snickered. I could always post an armed marine next to the piano 24 hours a day. Inkerman eyed Manny suspiciously. How can you be positive the Ruskies didn't break the string? I mean, glasnost or no glasnost, our friends over at the KGB are still drawing their paychecks. For all we know, they have an entire section that does nothing but try to figure out how to annoy the ambassador's wife. Manny said, you're not serious. Inkerman announced gravely, if the ambassador's wife is serious, I am serious. I examined the piano string under a magnifying glass, Manny said tiredly. There was no sign of it having been clipped or filed. You are an expert on such things, I take it. We are going to look goddamn silly shipping a piece of piano wire off to Washington for analysis. How come you never show up at the Spasso House concerts or lectures? Manny brought the back of a hand to his mouth and suppressed a yawn. The Russians have a word for people like me. It's «niekulturni». In his most condescending voice, he added, that means uncultured. I don't need a translation, Inkerman remarked stiffly. I took the same Foreign Service Russian course you did. He plucked a pen from a holder and printed action on the top of the note from the ambassador's wife. Then, reading out the words as his pen scratched across the paper, he wrote, Custer will personally supervise preparations for all Spasso House cultural events, as well as be present at these events. The station chief scrawled INK for Inkerman in the upper right-hand corner of the letter and tossed it into an oversized out-basket. From this moment in time on, he informed Manny, whatever goes wrong at Spasso House happens on your watch. You check the piano before a recital. You check the slide projector before a lecture. You start tomorrow. Some Russian or other has been invited over to read poems. You check the microphone to make sure it's working. You check the radiators to make sure they're hot. You check the drinks to make sure they haven't been spiked. You check the toilets to make sure they flush. You never know, Custer. Someone with your sensitivity could wind up liking poetry. Manny, never one to let his emotions show, took shelter behind a thin smile. Whatever, he mumbled. Inkerman, who as chief of station was in overall charge of embassy security, had already reduced him to warning new arrivals that walls had ears,
to spinning combination dials after working hours to make sure the safes had been properly locked.
Now he was trying to humiliate him further, to push him into retiring before his tour was up. Manny took a grim pleasure from hanging in, from surviving. If Moscow was going to be Custer's last stand, at least he would go out in style. Kuchkova, as Aida called Moscow, was shrouded in soot like dusk by the time she reached the Kremlin hospital not far from what she referred to as Trinity Square, the old name for Red Square. Wiping the slush off her galoshes on the pages of Pravda spread on the linoleum floor immediately inside the revolving door, she joined the queue that stretched the length of a dirty gray corridor, rounded a corner, and continued on past the bank of elevators, only one of which was in working condition. No matter how many times Aida waited online here, and she had queued once a week every week for the past 6 years, she never grew accustomed to the odors. Some weeks the corridor reeked of urine or vomit or ether, but most of the time the stench of disinfectant was so sharp it overpowered the other smells, stinging her nostrils, bringing tears to her eyes. Still, nobody who was fortunate enough to be on the line ever uttered a word of complaint about its length, about the odors. For at the end of the long, dim corridor was the door to the hospital pharmacy, and the unsmiling, white-coated women who distributed Western prescription drugs to those well-connected enough, or rich enough, or lucky enough to have the appropriate authorization. Aida had the appropriate authorization, a sheet of paper that had been folded and unfolded so many times it felt as soft to the touch as an old handkerchief. It had been obtained for her by her future ex-husband, Vadim, the same way he had found the apartment with a separate bedroom for her son and another for her father, the same way he had wangled her the 6-day cure at a rest home in the Crimea when her nerves were about to give out, the same way he got whatever he wanted, by getting people to return the favors he had done for them, and when that did not work, by paying in American dollars or British pounds or French francs. When Vadim was sober, Aida's attempts to express gratitude always irritated him. The less said, the better, he would reply, waving her thanks away with an embarrassed sweep of an arm.
Russia is a rat race. I just happen to be the fastest rat in town. Huh?
At the window up ahead, a white-haired woman whom Aida recognized as a regular in the corridor was arguing shrilly with one of the white-coated pharmacists.
How can that be? The woman cried. My daughter has been taking this drug for 3 years. Without it, she will need cataract surgery.
The pharmacist, a cranky time server with several steel teeth glistening in her small, tight mouth, shrugged listlessly.
I fill prescriptions if the drug in question is available. If not, not. You got a complaint? Take it up with the administrators.
When Aida's turn finally came, she carefully unfolded the letter of authorization and held it up for the pharmacist to read.
Has his weight changed? The pharmacist asked in a bored voice.
She glanced at the wall clock to see how long it would be before the night shift came on.
Aida said, It is the same as it was last week, 30 kilos. His dose is 2.5 milligrams multiplied by his weight.
I can read, the pharmacist commented sullenly. She disappeared behind the shelves crammed with imported drugs. Aida caught a glimpse of her spilling pills onto a glass tray and counting them out with a spatula. The pharmacist returned a few moments later with a small brown paper satchel filled with pills. She shook a ballpoint pen to start the ink flowing and filled in a gummed label, then licked the gummed side and slapped it onto the satchel. Aida read the label, which said, Purinethol, 75 milligrams of 6 mercaptopurine to be taken orally at supper each day. A tide of relief swept through her chest. The devil could be kept at arm's length for another 7 days.
You are sure you gave me enough for the week? She asked.
She forced a smile onto her face, hoping it would keep the pharmacist from becoming irked by the question. It didn't.
If you don't have confidence in the service here, you can always take your business elsewhere, the pharmacist muttered.
She stared arrogantly into Aida's face, knowing there was no place else to go in Moscow for foreign prescription drugs. Aida lowered her gaze, counted out 5 one-ruble bills from a small purse, and laid them soundlessly on the counter. Scooping up the rubles, the pharmacist looked over Aida's shoulder and called, Next!
Chapter 9. The room Inkerman put at Ben's disposal, one of 4 giving off the outer office, had been used as the CIA station's storage area. Most of the contents had been removed before Ben arrived, but one entire wall was still piled high with cartons of ribbons for the station's IBM typewriters. It was standard operating procedure to discard used ribbons in burn bags at the end of every workday so there would be no traces of the secret messages or reports that had been typed up. The fact that the station budgeted more for typewriter ribbons than for all other office supplies put together never failed to astonish the accountant from the Office of Budget Management who audited the books. How do you manage to spend $10,180 a year on typewriter ribbons? He would ask the station chief. Easy, Inkerman would answer, his pudgy face totally devoid of human expression. We use IBM ribbons instead of tinsel on the office Christmas tree. Ben had to smile when Inkerman's secretary, Mehetabel Macy, told him the story by way of apologizing for the boxes of ribbons in his cramped quarters. We wouldn't want our 415 to be uncomfortable, she said with exaggerated sweetness. She lingered with her back against the jamb of the open office door, her skirt hiked up on her thighs, her long legs crossed at the ankles, one toe suggestively dipping in and out of a suede shoe. As long as there's room for a table and chair, Ben assured her, I'll get by. She held out an index card to Ben. The top number is the code for the electronic lock on the door, she explained breathlessly. The bottom one is for the safe. Don't change either of them. If, God forbid, anything were to happen to you, we would want to be able to get our hot hands on your little secrets. Ben took the card. Thanks. He stood gazing at her until, with a bird-like flutter of her narrow shoulders, she pivoted on a heel and headed for her desk.
For God's sake, she called, don't be bashful about asking me if you need anything.
She seemed to give the word anything a special twist. Ben looked around at what the half-dozen agents assigned to the station called the ribbon room, then went to work. He set out the station's cipher log on the small metal table, along with the thin notebook that had been in the sealed attaché case shipped to him from Washington, and started to plow through the station chief's backlist of enciphered, sensitive, compartmented information cables for 1967. Brushing off Miss Macy's flirtatious forays, "Well, if it isn't our bashful 415 slumming on the 10th floor." Ben managed to spend an hour a day most weekdays, and an hour and a half a day most weekends in the ribbon room. It was slow going, but it was meant to be slow going. Following very precise instructions, he was careful to get Ironweed off to an unhurried start. It's essential not to rush things once you're in Moscow, the nuts and bolts man had warned him at the last briefing session before he left for his first posting in Czechoslovakia. You want to take your sweet time working through the cables. Late one Saturday afternoon, after spending a boring hour and a half in the ribbon room, Ben headed for the new office building around the corner from the embassy to see if the thermal underwear he had ordered from Finland had arrived. A blast of Arctic air hit him as he left the embassy. The cold seemed to invade the folds of his sheepskin overcoat. Two Soviet militiamen, their collars up, their ear flaps down, their cheeks burning from the sub-zero temperature, nodded stiffly when he passed. The last brittle beams of midwinter sunlight were grazing the rooftops as Ben picked his way along the sanded street. A vendor wearing tinted plastic ski goggles had set up a makeshift stand on the corner and was selling hazelnuts by the handful to people waiting for the trolley. A dozen peasant women in thick quilted overcoats tied with rope belts, their heads hidden in washed-out shawls, were half-heartedly chipping away at the ice in front of a drab government building. Seeing the sparks of ice flying off in all directions brought back to Ben the bizarre gesture of the woman who rummaged in the debris of language, who listened to the silences and the spaces between words. In his mind's eye, he recreated the contours of her broken nose alive with freckles, saw her sucking on the sliver of ice, felt her blue lips brush lightly against his, watched her white feather disappear amid the falling crystals of snow. Ben had relived the brief encounter a dozen times. There had been something about her that was both haunted and hunted. She had been beaten down by the system. He remembered her story of having learned English in prison, but had managed to achieve a measure of nobility by continuing to war against it. Was she, like him, an aficionado of lost causes? Would this have been one of the points they found in common if they had taken the trouble to search? There were moments when he bitterly regretted letting her slip out of his grasp, slip out of his life. There were other moments when he really hoped to Christ they would not meet again. Inside the new office building, Ben thumped his feet on a mat to get the slush off his boots. There was a hint of frustration in the enthusiasm he invested in the gesture. Shaking his head to clear away the vision of Aida, he looked up to find himself face to face with Manny Custer. There was this frog name of Voltaire, Manny said in a lazy drawl that he slipped into whenever he was afraid of sounding too highbrow. He was on his deathbed, so the story goes, so it was told to me, and some priest was trying to talk him into denying the devil in this Voltaire character. You know what he went and told the priest? He told him... Manny didn't try to cap the mocking laugh that seeped from his lips. This is not the time to make enemies. Ben was at a loss, and his expression showed it. Why are you telling me this? Manny shrugged a heavy shoulder. It had been a long week, and it was not over yet. I thought you would read the story the same way I do. Ben grinned. You mean, as if there is ever a time to make enemies? Whatever, Manny agreed. I'm on my coffee break, only I don't drink coffee. Come on, I'll break a golden rule and buy you one for the road. Except for a couple of code clerks and the man who ran the embassy's automobile pool, Sam's lounge down the wide hallway inside the new office building was deserted. Sliding his bulky body into a booth, Manny called to the bartender, "The usual scotch on the usual rocks, followed by the usual chaser, huh?" "Two," said Ben. "Two usual scotches on the usual rocks, two chasers," repeated Manny. When the bartender had set the drinks on the table, Ben said, "You're right, of course, about it always being the wrong time to make enemies. I'm sorry if I rubbed you the wrong way at that security briefing of yours. I know you have a job to do. On the other hand, you seem to treat Perestroika and Glasnost as if it were all a communist plot to lull us to sleep." Manny massaged his pitted nose with the side of his glass. If I remember right, you are a Russian speaker. You know the word передышка? Breathing space, Ben said. Manny shook the ice in his glass so that it tinkled musically. You want my opinion? What the Russians are after isn't perestroika, but передышка. The economy is an unholy mess. They're buying time to put their house in order, after which the Cold War could, I don't say will, I say could, start up again. Manny knocked back the rest of his drink. You want evidence? Your glasnost and your perestroika notwithstanding, the KGB, as far as I know, is still doing business at the same stand. So is the CIA. And so am I. So, nothing has changed? Manny pushed his empty glass to one side and attacked the chaser, a mug of pale beer. What I think is, until all this perestroika business irons itself out one way or another, we have got to be careful not to let down our guard. The Russia I know, and don't particularly love, is a country where anarchy lurks just under the surface, along with 38,000 nuclear warheads. Ben tried to interrupt, but the embassy's security chief raised his voice and plunged on. I know what you're going to say. You're going to say, what about all the reforms? Look, nobody knows if these reforms are for real. Even assuming they're for real, nobody knows if they can work. What we do know is there's a lot of folks out there. Manny let his voice sink into a husky stage whisper on both sides of what used to be called the Iron Curtain, right? Waiting for the great Houdini and company to fall on their fat faces. Me? I don't think he's going to be able to turn the ballgame around, but I'm all for giving him a fair shot at it. Squinting at his guest, Manny drained his mug of beer. Ben realized the security officer had had more than one for the road. Listen, Manny continued, wiping foam off his lips with the back of his hand. I was one of the first to say that the great Houdini had the makings of a reformer, and I got into hot water for saying it. I might not want to come right out and admit it in so many words. Hell, changing colors isn't easy for an old cold warrior like me. But in my own way, I'm even rooting for him. What the hell? Your average Russian is as nice as your average American, and they sure stored up points in heaven knocking off the Nazis. I remember reading somewhere that 10 out of every 13 Germans killed during the war bought it on the Russian front, so they earned their chance, that's what I say. Manny leaned across the table and winked at Ben. But take a tip from an old pro, Mr. Bassett. Keep your powder dry. Manny leaned back and rubbed the ball of his forefinger around the rim of his mug several times. Then, sighing, checked his watch. Jesus, I got to go. He tucked several bills under the empty mug. I'm off to babysit some poet at Spasso House, he said, sliding out of the booth, pulling his overcoat and fur hat after him. Is there a reading? Asked Ben. You have a soft spot for Russian poets, Mr. Bassett? I have a soft spot for Russian poetry, Ben retorted. I have a feeling you're full of soft spots. Manny hovered over Ben, his head cocked, eyeing him suspiciously. Tell me something, Mr. Bassett. What is it you really do at the embassy? Ben's pulse stirred. I keep house for the Seven Dwarfs. That being the case, what brings you up to Inkerman's bailiwick so often? Ben forced a grin onto his face. You really do keep your ear to the ground. The Marine who checks your green badge on the 9th floor writes your name in a log. Part of my housekeeping chores include enciphering status reports, Ben explained. I can't store the ciphers downstairs because it's a white badge area, so Mr. Inkerman loaned me the use of his ribbon room. It has a safe and a table to work on. The housekeeper before you didn't do enciphering. The dwarfs had one of the code clerks in the bubble working part-time for them. I killed 2 birds with 1 stone, less strain on the budget. You never told me you were trained in ciphers. You never asked. Manny, suddenly very sober, studied Ben and grunted. That is correct. I never asked. But I am asking now. I was trained by Army Intelligence in the manly art of enciphering and deciphering. Why all the questions? Coughing up a belly laugh, Manny thrust his arms into the sleeves of his overcoat and hiked it onto his shoulders. Just keeping my powder dry. Aida glanced at the hands that ran counterclockwise on her tiny wristwatch. She had intended to stop when the hour was up, but something she preferred not to examine too closely was pushing her to read one more. "Do I have time? Do you have patience for a last poem?" she asked the 50 or so Americans gathered in the ballroom of the ambassador's official residence, Spaso House. "By all means," the ambassador, who spoke fluent Russian and was translating her poems into English, told her. Miss Harkenrider, sitting on a folding chair in the first row, started clapping rhythmically, and the other women in the audience took it up. Aida adjusted her round, steel-rimmed eyeglasses. The Americans in the ballroom settled down. Shuffling through her papers, Aida found the poem she wanted. Some lines scratched on the back of a napkin before she knew she was looking for it, which reinforced the sensation she had of going through motions that were predestined. Her eyes fixed on the napkin, she said a few words about the poem. The ambassador asked her in what sense she was using a particular Russian idiom, and when she told him, he repeated the gist of her remarks in English. "She describes this poem as a freshly plucked plant, so fresh that you will be the first to hear it. She says the act of listening to a poem is what gives it life. Rather than tell you more, she invites you to interpret the poem into life." He turned to Aida expectantly. She had spotted him the instant he appeared, pushing through the double door at the back of the ballroom halfway through her first poem, his long sheepskin overcoat. Every detail engraved itself on her brain, still on but open. A hat, a scarf, a package wrapped in brown paper tucked under an arm. His dark hair, disheveled the one time she had seen him, flattened from having worn the hat. His lips parted in astonishment, so she imagined, so she hoped, at seeing her again. He had stood next to a heavy-set man who kept scowling at his wristwatch after every poem. His back was against the wall, his body taut. His eyes, riveted on hers, seemed to put an unspoken question. The poem would be her answer. She recited it in Russian, in a still, flat voice, letting the spaces between the words convey the emotion she hoped was there. After she had read it a second time, the ambassador, who had been scrawling a rough translation on a yellow notepad, looked up and said in English, "I don't think I'll be giving away the plot if I tell you this is a love poem. I hope I can do it justice." And he translated it into English. "I have hung on words you left unsaid, been moved to tears by tears you left unshed, caught your heart's ache through the snow's storm. As proof I tender my iced lips for you to warm." When the applause died away, people began drifting over to the long table covered with zakuski and bottles of Georgian wine. With the ambassador trailing in her wake, Aida plowed through the group like an icebreaker, so it seemed to Manny Custer, watching from the wall, and helped herself to several wedges of toast covered with caviar. A group gathered around her. The ambassador offered her a glass of wine and raised his own glass to her. "To Russian poets," he declared, "who kept the flame alive." Aida thought about this. "Some did, some did not," she replied dryly in her accented English. "But I must anyhow drink to your toast because I'm thirsty." The Americans around Aida laughed. The cultural attaché who had invited her asked, "Aside from the fact that one is composed in English and the other in Russian, do you see a difference between American poetry and Russian poetry?" Aida noticed Ben at the edge of the group. He let his eyes drift up in their sockets to indicate what he thought of the question. Aida, feeling the irresistible pull of a conspiracy, fought the urge to respond with a laugh. "American poetry," she told the cultural attaché, her face serious, her eyes dancing with amusement, "wants to be horizontal, which is to say it treats people as if they were beautiful items in one of those postal order catalogs published by your Mr. L. Bean. The result, more often than not, is poetry who skates on the surface of thin ice. Our Russian poetry wants to be vertical, which is to say it runs risks. It plunges to the heart of the belly of the whale. It explores how people live and love and how they die." "Did my translations capture the verticality of your poems?" the ambassador inquired. "The poetry, whether vertical or horizontal, is what's usually lost in translation," Ben commented over the heads of those in front of him. Several of the embassy people, Manny Custer among them, turned to stare at him. "I mean," Ben added, looking at everyone but Aida, How can you translate the spaces between the words? I don't see what the spaces between the words has to do with poetry, the ambassador objected sourly. That's where the poetry is, Ben insisted. That is more or less how I would describe it, agreed Aida. She and Ben exchanged looks. In the spaces between the words is where you must hunt for the poetry. The ambassador, glancing from Aida to Ben and back, said, American poets may be skating on thin ice, but our critics are plunging, how did you put it, to the heart of the belly of the whale. Aida got into a long discussion with the ambassador's wife about the feminist movement in Russia, or more precisely, the reasons why there was none. When she looked around for Ben, he had disappeared. Helping her on with her coat later, the cultural attaché offered her a ride home in an embassy car, but Aida said she preferred to take the metro, and the attaché, aware that many Russians still did not want to be seen getting in or out of an embassy car, didn't press her. The night was crystalline cold as Aida headed back along the peripheric toward the Gorky Street metro stop and the train that would take her to Riechnoy Vokzal at the end of the line and her rendezvous with Vadim on the boat. Several blocks from the embassy, a figure materialized out of the darkness. One instant she was alone, the next, Ben was walking in lockstep beside her. How do you know about the bean catalog? He asked, as if he were picking up the thread of an interrupted conversation. It is because of my future ex, she said. She tried to keep her voice from betraying her excitement. It had been a while since her pulse had been set to throbbing by the presence of a man as opposed to an idea. Vadim is what we call an operator. He has a dozen irons and a dozen fires, so every now and again, against my will, he insists on offering presents to my son. Last year on Sava's name day, Vadim gave him one of Mr. L. Bean's catalogs, God only knows how he organized it, and told him he could have one thing in it. Sava agonized over the choice for a week. He made up his mind a dozen times only to change it at the last moment. Ben slipped his arm through hers. The first time I saw you, I wanted to make love to the body I imagined under all those layers of clothing, he said. Only when you had disappeared into the storm of snow did it dawn on me that I could fall in love with you. She could feel his elbow pressing against her ribcage. For once in her life, she was at a loss for words. My son settled on a red knife with many blades that the catalog said was used by soldiers in Switzerland, she continued. Her breath came in shallow gasps. There was even a magnifying glass in it, though what a magnifying glass was doing in a knife, I do not know. Did you hear what I said? She looked at him. I heard what you said, yes. If you want to sleep with me, you can come right out and say so without confusing lust and love. The dimple under her lower lip trembled. Without confusing me in the process. I want to sleep with you. And more. When she didn't reply, Ben muttered, For Christ's sake, say something. Smiling the bittersweet smile that always appeared on her face when she quoted lines from Akhmatova, she recited, You have come 10 years too late. I am glad to see you all the same. End of side 2. To continue, change side selector switch and turn the cassette over.